challenge of radical atheism has been laid before us by the publication of Martin Hoglund's astonishing new book in the prestigious Meridian series at Stanford University Press entitled Radical Atheism, Derrida and the Time of Life. The book, by the way, is available outside along with books of the other speakers here if you would like to purchase them. In response to this challenge, this colloquium has convened a distinguished group of philosophers and theorists who have read the book in manuscript and were moved to consider the challenge it describes and to judge the value of the prescriptions it advances. Let me say quickly, by way of a gnomic introduction, that radical atheism is distinguished from traditional atheism by virtue of its thoroughgoing iconoclasm, its rigorous, systematic deconstruction of theistic ideals and idealities, the ghosts of theology that continue to tempt our thought. Even more decisively, it mystifies and discredits the illusions that underpin our desire for those ideals, conceived as transcendent and ultimately beyond reach. Radical atheism is atheistic not only because it denies the possibility, for example, of immortal life, but it demonstrates the undesirability of even wanting such a thing. Martin Hoglund, whose book is the focus of our attention today, received a BA with distinction from the University of Stockholm. He worked there for a while as a newspaper literary critic and published a book in Swedish on modernism and Derrida entitled Chronophobia. It was written in Swedish. The English is Chronophobia, Essays on Time and Finitude. He came to America in 2002 to study for a master's degree in comparative literature from the University of SUNY Buffalo. In 2005, he came to Cornell as a graduate student in comparative literature. Although I happen to be one of the three faculty members on his graduate committee, it's only a conceit to say that I've directed his work, since it's rather he who has pointedly redirected my thinking. Conversely, his work has profited notably from the guidance it received from Rodolphe Gachet, the distinguished head of comparative literature at Buffalo, and from our own Jonathan Culler, the director of his thesis, a thesis that's all but written on Proust, Nabokov, and Virginia Woolf, and will soon be another book. Both of those directors are here today to celebrate this publication and to participate in the colloquium. A longer version of the conference paper will be, longer versions of the conference papers will be published in a special issue of the journal, The New Centennial Review, which will also feature responses to Martin Hoglund's work by Ernesto Laclau, Catherine Malabou, and Vicky Kirby. At the MLA convention in 2005, I began a little talk at one of the panels as follows, if I may be allowed to quote myself. It's Hegel, I think, who points out that the first generation of disciples always gets their master's teaching wrong, in fact, dead wrong. They interpret the master's teaching in ways that directly contradict his clear intentions, usually with deadening results. Recent Kantian, recent readings and interpretations of Derrida have turned him into a normative philosopher, a Kantian idealist, whose insistence on the unconditionality of finitude and whose interest in religion has led commentators to identify him with Immanuel Levinas and a holy, pious ethics of the other. Thinking of Robert Bernasconi, Drusilla Cornell, the Philosophy of the Limits, Simon Critchley, and others. Happily, and I'm still quoting myself, happily there is on the horizon a third generation of readers of Derrida who have begun to set the record straight. One of the most important, I think, is Martin Hoglund, a young Swedish philosopher who's already published a book in Swedish, whose remarkable article on Derrida and Levinas that will appear shortly in Diacritics, it has appeared. In it, he immaculately demonstrates the extent to which Derrida's work, from its early insistence on in L'Écriture et la Différence, has been atheistically opposed to the ethical utopianism of Levinas, not to mention his theistic presuppositions, the priority of good over evil, of peace over violence, etc. Despite their critical use of identical terms like trace and the other, Hoglund demonstrates that their syntax is radically distinct and their intention diametrically opposed. In his current book, he begins by focusing on the illogical logic of autoimmunity, a term that appears late in Derrida. The operation it names, however, is shown by Hodlin to be at work in Derrida's earliest writing. It's already implicit in the notion of classe or différence, as Hodlin meticulously demonstrates. By reading autoimmunity backwards into the entirety of Derrida's writing, thereby confounding any drastic distinction between early and late Derrida, Hodlin has been able to keep in sight the radical consequences of Derrida's discovery, his invention of a new logic of contradiction, one that not only accounts for and undermines the traditional philosophical logical logic based on the Aristotelian principle of non-contradiction, even in its attenuated Hegelian forms, but provides the riven ground of a new affirmation of old notions like democracy, justice, and hospitality. I'm particularly happy to be able to participate in a colloquium that advances the claims of atheism, radical atheism. For decades, I've struggled here at this university in all the minor ways I can to resist the theologizing of the university. I remember some years ago being asked to respond to a talk given by Mark Taylor, a well-known Derridean theologian, who came to this campus to deplore the fact that we had no department or school of theology. I reminded him that unlike our sister Ivy League universities, Cornell was not founded by Puritans. Cornell was founded explicitly by Ezra Cornell and Andrew Dixon White as a non-sectarian university, predicated on scientific reason, not on theology. In the 19th century, ministers in the region railed against godless Cornell. One Ithaca preacher wrote to the Baptists of New York to inform them that of 476 Cornell students, only 78 could be called Christian. He wrote that the influence of Andrew Dixon White, Cornell's first president, his influence was to discredit the authenticity of the scriptures. His lectures uphold rationalism, destroy belief in miracles, that he opposes soul saving, is hostile to the gospel of the grace of God, and that in general he thinks religious doctrines of slight importance. As Morris Bishop in his History of Cornell concludes, the students joyously, quote, I'm quoting Morris Bishop, the students joyously help blacken the university's fair name. A group amused themselves in October 1878 by forming the Young Men's Infidel Association. At one meeting, it was moved that God be declared out of order. The motion was defeated on the ground that God was not a member. I earnestly hope that the colloquium today will serve to blacken even more Cornell's fair name.